some amount of emotional lability up and down is totally expected. But the difference between that and a mood disorder, depression, anxiety, is where you don't feel like you're pulling out of it and you don't feel like you are able to adapt to the situation that you're in and manage the things that you need to manage.
The American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists calls the 12 weeks after giving birth the fourth trimester. In this series, the Women's Health Cast is airing episodes about physical recovery, postpartum mental health, birth control after pregnancy, and more. Dr. Ryan McDonald joined the Women's Health Cast to talk about postpartum depression and anxiety. Dr. Ryan McDonald joined the Women's Health Cast to talk about postpartum depression and anxiety. Dr. McDonald is the clinical professor of obstetrics and gynecology in the UW Department of OBGYN. He talked about postpartum mental health signs and symptoms, a variety of treatment and support options, and important resources for parents and families navigating postpartum depression and anxiety. From the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine and Public Health Department of Obstetrics and Gynecology, I'm Jackie Askins, and this is the Women's Health Cast. I'm very excited to welcome Dr. Ryan McDonald back to the Women's Health Cast today to talk about postpartum mental health. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me here. It's absolutely my pleasure to be back.
So we are working on a series right now about kind of common fourth trimester issues, things that pop up in the post-birth period. And I felt like mental health concerns are super common for a lot of people, and it would be really great to spend a little time learning more about some of the signs, the symptoms, and new treatment options, as well as sort of old standbys. For folks who aren't familiar, can you – I've said like postpartum mental health. What kinds of issues are we talking about when we say that?
Well, mental health care spans a huge range of topics, of course, and the most common being anxiety, depression, and substance use. But there are others that we also treat in the scope of our practice.
How common are some of these issues that we see?
Well, this is something that really has been getting more of a spotlight over the last few years. And we have recent data from 2021 U.S. data that shows that as many as 1 in 5 people are facing mental health issues during their pregnancy or in the period within the first year after pregnancy. We also know that this prevalence is increasing. So the frequency at which we're seeing these has really doubled over the last 10 years. And some of that's probably paying better attention and, you know, screening patients better, but I think there really is an increase in how people are struggling with their mental health care. I also think that it's important for people to still realize that even though we are screening patients and we're finding more mental health problems, this continues to be a hugely under-recognized and under-treated problem. We know that untreated disease leads to worse outcomes for moms and babies. Problems like parents bonding with their children or, you know, having substance use issues, smoking, or even having their other healthcare issues be worsened by their mental health problems. And for babies, we see higher chances of really terrible outcomes like preterm delivery and stillbirth in patients whose mental health issues are not addressed. So I think this is a really important topic that is affecting a lot of our patients.
Do we know if anxiety or depression are more common? Like, which one of those seems to pop up more for people in the postpartum period?
It seems that the, you know, kind of rate of anxiety and depression are pretty close to equal for people. And so somewhere around 1 in 5 to 1 in 7 people will experience either of these conditions or both at the same time.
You mentioned that they're maybe under-recognized as conditions, and that can happen, I feel like, from both a healthcare interaction standpoint, like a provider not recognizing or screening, but also from an individual standpoint. Like, I'm experiencing big emotional changes because I just had a baby and I'm figuring out how to take care of a new human, and that's new and weird. And so maybe
what I'm feeling. Is it just that? Is it just adjusting to no sleep? Or how can someone tell if what they're experiencing is kind of the normal upheaval of having an infant around, or if it is something more complex that could use more attention?
I hoped you'd ask this question, because I tell my patients all the time when they're getting ready for the end of pregnancy that they are about to enter this time of chaos, because the challenges of raising a child and having this huge change in your identity, getting less sleep, and all of the changes that are going on in somebody's body when they have just delivered a child are unlike any other period in someone's life. So naturally, there is going to be a profound adjustment period. And some of that is going to be associated with mood fluctuations that are extremely positive, but at other times feel very negative. And I think it's important for people to know that it is not only normal and expected, but to give themselves some grace that this is going to happen, and to warn their family and their partners that this is also part of the experience. So some amount of emotional lability up and down is totally expected. But the difference between that and a mood disorder, depression, anxiety, is where you don't feel like you're pulling out of it, and you don't feel like you are able to adapt to the situation that you're in and manage the things that you need to manage. For example, if somebody feels like they're crying at the drop of a hat, and they're really irritable with their partner, that might be just totally normal. But if, on the other hand, their mood is so down that they feel like they can't get out of bed and they can't take care of their infant and they can't take a shower, not because they don't have time, but because they don't have the energy, this is where it really is disrupting their ability to perform their daily activities. And it may be an actual problem, a mental health problem at that point.
Are there demographics of people? Do we see any trends in who experiences postpartum depression or postpartum anxiety? Or are there any risk factors that can make someone more likely to experience these issues?
Well, I think foremost, it's important to understand that perinatal mental health issues can affect mothers and birthing people of all ages, races, and ethnicities. So this does not It's not limited to a certain group of people in any way. There are some risk factors, meaning some background features that may make somebody more likely to have a mental health issue. And these kind of cover a lot of different groups. So you may find yourself in one or more of these groups. First-time moms, just all of those rapid changes that we just talked about are more likely to deal with mental health issues. People who find themselves with a lack of support, maybe lack of family or friend or partner support. People who have a high stress environment. And that means a lot of different things to people. But frankly, if you say to yourself that my stress level is so high that like I don't sleep well, or I am like constantly feeling like I need to be on high alert, that level of stress could be having a negative impact on your health, including your mental health. We certainly see also along that same line that people who are suffering from racism are under chronic stress, and that is a risk factor for mental health disorders. Two other important ones that I think people need to know about are adolescents and people who are victims of intimate partner violence. And that doesn't just mean physical violence or sexual violence. It can be emotional or mental as well. If somebody feels like they are chronically threatened, then they're more likely to develop mental health problems.
What about if you have a mental health issue like anxiety or depression prior to pregnancy, so you're already diagnosed and being treated for that? How does that affect your outcomes, I guess, after pregnancy or your experience after delivery?
Yeah, I'm so glad you asked that, because I probably should have said that as the foremost risk factor. if somebody has mental health problems that they have dealt with in the remote past, and certainly if it's an active issue going into pregnancy, then it is more likely to be a continuing issue during the pregnancy and in the postpartum period. But one thing you might not know is that if somebody has anxiety, they are more likely to develop postpartum depression than the average person. So it is the issue that, you know, if there is some underlying mental health concerns, it's extremely important that this be part of the postpartum planning that that individual and their provider are doing while they are getting ready for the end of pregnancy. And, you know, one thing that I hear from my patients a lot is that they maybe don't want to be on their mood stabilizing medicines while they're pregnant, and so they might go off of them. So I think it's really important to talk about this with your doctor. You know, when would be the right time to go back on those medicines so that maybe you're heading off a flare of postpartum depression?
Is it necessary to taper off of those medications during pregnancy or before pregnancy, or can someone maintain the therapies that were working for them even through their pregnancy?
Yeah, good question. And this is very individualized. So I don't think that there is a answer here that's going to be the right thing for everyone. I think this is a very important conversation at the beginning of your prenatal care. What I would discourage anyone from doing is stopping medications that have kept their mood stable and keeping them functioning well before they talk to their doctors. Because what happens sometimes is patients, you know, stop their mood stabilizing medicines, then they come see me a month later for their first OB visit, and now we're starting to uncover some situations that could be dangerous for them or for their baby. So really approach that carefully. I do think, though, for patients who have relatively mild disease, there may be a role for tapering off of some medicines in early pregnancy. Whereas for the majority of my patients who have moderate or worse anxiety or depression symptoms, they actually are probably going to be better served to stay on those medicines that are working well for them throughout their pregnancy. But an important topic that really needs a one-on-one approach.
What does the research look like, or the safety data look like for like infant outcomes and fetal outcomes if a parent stays on their mood stabilizing medication throughout their pregnancy? Do we have a lot of information about outcomes for the babies after that?
We do, and we're always looking for more. But we have years of safety data on some of our most common medicines that we use for mood control during pregnancy. So the most common medicine that has been studied for this use is called sertraline. It might be commonly known to some people as Zoloft. That is one of the brand names. And this has decades of safety data. This is considered to be very safe for babies with no significant increased risk of things like birth defects or, you know, behavior problems or anything like that. Another common medicine that is used is one called escitalopram or Lexapro. Also has very good safety data, but it's a newer medicine. That said, these are both have been used for years. Common side effects for moms would be things like some nausea or diarrhea, kind of GI upset issues. There can be some dry mouth. It's also pretty common to have some kind of lack of libido or sexual desire. And most of those side effects get better over time. So they tend to be pretty mild and well-tolerated. Babies can have two issues that I think we need to talk about. One is a very rare pulmonary condition, and another is a more common kind of temporary irritability that happens after birth. So the respiratory condition is called persistent pulmonary hypertension of the newborn. This can be very dangerous. It can even be life-threatening, but fortunately, it is extremely rare. So I would consider this to be so rare as to generally not be influenced in my decision about whether or not to use these medicines. The other thing that I mentioned is this temporary irritability, and this is what everybody thinks about when they think about these medicines. They don't want their baby to go through a withdrawal from being on these medicines. This actually, by the way, happens to grownups. If we abruptly stop taking sertraline or escitalopram or any other medicine in this class called selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors or SSRIs, we will generally feel lousy. We'll feel irritable and cranky and maybe not sleep well and feel a little temperature dysregulated and maybe feel like our appetite's not great. Exact same thing happens to babies. So immediately after birth, in that first several days, babies may be a little more irritable, a little more cranky. They may cry a little bit more readily, and they just might be a little more restless and unhappy. Fortunately, this is generally managed just by skin to skin and some extra soothing and a quiet environment and low lighting and all the things that most of us are doing with newborns anyways. Even though nobody wants to make their baby feel uncomfortable and go through this irritability, for somebody who needs these medicines to feel like they have good mood control, you're going to be able to care for this kiddo so much more effectively if your mental health is in a good state than risking that for the benefit of maybe avoiding a week or two of extra irritability.
So we've talked about sort of the risk-benefit profile of staying on these medications during pregnancy. I'm also curious about if we have any information about these medications and breastfeeding.
This is an easy question for me. I would say unequivocally, you should not avoid breastfeeding for the benefit of your baby because of these medicines. Actually, there's very good literature that shows that women who do choose to breastfeed have lower risks of mental health disorders in the postpartum period. The amount of medicine that babies are getting exposed to through the breast milk is very, very small. And as I've already described, I feel that these medicines are generally quite safe in pregnancy. They're even more so in the postpartum period. So I would say if you are willing and able to breastfeed, absolutely do it for all of the benefits of improved mental health and improved bonding. And I would not make any changes to your SSRI type medicines for that reason.
So we've kind of detoured to treatments a little earlier than I expected to. And I want to circle back to make sure that we also talk a lot about signs, symptoms, and next steps if someone feels like they're experiencing a postpartum mood disorder. You talked a little bit about that spectrum of like normal, common emotional adjustment to the new situation that is being a parent to a mental health issue that's significant enough to suggest intervention to make someone feel like maybe I should seek help. I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit more about really the signs that someone might be experiencing. Just to make sure we, I guess, have a good understanding of like when it is worth reaching out to a healthcare provider about what's going on for us.
Yeah. Well, I think foremost is if somebody is concerned that they are not able to keep themselves or their baby safe, this is the biggest red flag. And so part of what I really want people to take away from this is if they are having any thoughts of harming themselves or harming their baby, or if they are feeling like their mood is so poor that they cannot care for their baby, this needs emergent contact to a health provider. And along those lines, you know, some of the most common signs of things like depression or symptoms of depression are just lack of interest and feeling like their mood is really down. And so in the spectrum of that are going to be some people who don't have the energy to take care of their baby. But this is still a really big deal, right? So you have to seek care if you feel like your disinterest or your lack of energy is preventing you from caring for your little one. So I think that's the most important thing. But other symptoms of depression could be things like feeling guilt or worthlessness, or feeling like your sleep is really poor, either because you cannot sleep or because you are so sleepy that you cannot get going. Feeling like your concentration is terrible. That one I got to take with a grain of salt, right? Because, of course, you're going to feel like you're sleep deprived and your mood's all over the place, right? And so there's going to be some lack of focus that happens to everybody. Appetite can be extremely high or low in people who have depression. And sometimes people feel like they're just like their muscles really just either don't have any energy, or they're kind of like constantly on a go in the way that is like kind of over agitated. So I think the point of this, though, is that there are many symptoms, and some of them can be totally normal and just kind of like, especially in this time of you know, considerable change. But some of it also is also what we're looking for is like, do symptoms get to the level where they're really impairing your ability to function? Those are generally symptoms of depression. Anxiety tends to be more of a kind of a sense of kind of hypervigilance, where you are worried about things that maybe don't rise to the level of causing worry for most people. Maybe you are like checking things for safety over and over. Maybe you cannot sleep. But really the hallmark of true anxiety is, are your feelings of anxiousness so severe that they are causing you to feel physically unwell, or they are preventing you from, or they are actually, you know, at the level where you can't function normally because you are impaired by your anxiety.
You just described what individuals should look out for. And I'm curious if you ever talk to partners about what they can be on the lookout for too. Sometimes, so this is just me, I cannot ask for help. It's just pathologically impossible for me to ask for help. And I feel like that is probably not an uncommon experience. It's very hard for us to say, I think something is wrong.
Yeah.
I need help. And sometimes having an outside observer pick up on things could be useful if something is really wrong, but we don't really know how to get the assistance that we need. I guess I'm just curious if you ever have advice for family members or partners of things to kind of be on the lookout for as well.
This resonates with me in so many ways. As a provider of prenatal care, as a father, as a human being who feels many of the things that you just shared about myself, you know, I also am a chronic under-asker for help. And that's not good for any of us, of course, especially at this time where we all need help, right? You know, I mean, the old maxim that it takes a village to raise a baby, it could not be more true. You know, when we are in a situation where we have one caregiver who is doing the vast majority of the work for a baby, that really sets up so many challenges. And one of them is that they then feel like they have to do everything and that they are failing if they can't do everything. I do think, you know, your question makes me really want to advocate for two things, you know, to please give yourselves the grace to ask for help. So hard to do. I get that. But if you can make sure that people know that you're going to need help and that it's going to be hard for you to ask help for help, and kind of identify like what are some of the areas where you're going to like be more likely to feel like you have to do everything on your own. But like those conversations before baby comes are so important. And then the question about like what can families do, you know, there actually is a lot. You know, I'm talking to family members now. You know your partner and your family member better than anyone. Like, you know what it looks like when they're stressed and they're overwhelmed. You probably also know better than most what are the things that they are putting energy into every week that are important for them to feel grounded. Can you help with, you know, making sure that the dishes are clean? Can you help with the laundry? Can you, you know, bring them a meal. Like those kinds of things that we do to support each other when somebody has had a delivery are huge. Specifically for mental health, you also have the keenest insight about when somebody is not doing well. And, you know, you're going to see these mood changes and fluctuations. And sometimes what you need to do then is say, you know, I'm here. And what do you need right now? You know, do you need me to just hear you? Do you need me to actually help you and do something for you? Or do you just need a hug? I call those the three H's, and sometimes we all need those, okay? But you are in such a special place to be able to understand what somebody else needs, but you may just have to ask. And, you know, some days are going to be hard. That's the way it goes. There are also some really great resources, and I wanted to make sure that we get to these. If you have a computer or a smartphone, which you probably do because you're listening to this, you can go to the American College of Obstetrics and Gynecology. The abbreviation is ACOG, A-C-O-G, and type in perinatal mental health. There is a whole toolkit for patients, providers, and families that has educational resources that I think is a really great place to start if you're just looking for more details on these topics. And while we're talking about resources, I think there's two other things to know about. One is 988. If you don't know what that number is, that is the National Suicide Hotline. That is something that everybody should know and should use freely if they have any concerns at all. There's also a phone number that you can reach through the Health Resources and Services Administration that's 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, and free. It's a confidential mental health hotline. It's 1-833-9-HELP-4-MOMS or 1-833-943-5746. So having those resources available any time of day is great. Because sometimes you just can't get a hold of your provider as quickly as you want to, but make sure you're reaching out to them too.
All of the resources that Dr. McDonald just mentioned will be linked in the description for today's episode as well. So if you didn't have time to write them down, feel free to just click on the link for today's episode title and we'll include them in the notes for that. So we've talked about understanding signs and symptoms, and now I want to ask about what's next. We recognize that something is not quite right in our mental health, who do we reach out to and what kind of help can healthcare teams provide at this juncture?
Yeah, that's a great question. And we did kind of go out of order a little bit because medication is not the first thing that we do. So, you know, the first thing that we do is we try to identify people who are dealing with mental health challenges. And so, you know, your doctor who's providing your doctor or your midwife, who is providing your prenatal care should be screening for mental health concerns multiple times during your pregnancy, as well as during the postpartum time. And, you know, we have standardized screening tools that we use for this. This is super important because we're trying to identify people who might need help. We're also trying to normalize this, you know, by this being part of a routine prenatal care and by having conversations like this. We're hoping that we are breaking down some of that stigma that people have that, you know, they just need to be stronger or, you know, somehow better in order to not be struggling with mental health. This is healthcare. This is basic healthcare. You wouldn't not go seek care if you broke your leg. Why would somebody not seek care if they feel like their mood is preventing them from functioning well? That said, that's the world we live in. So we try to screen everybody for this. It is also the case that there are other things that look like mental health disorders that are not strictly caused by an imbalance in the brain. For example, thyroid disease is a very common cause of people feeling like their mood is not either up or down the way that they expect. Similarly, substance use, even common substances like marijuana, you know, or too much caffeine can mimic some of the symptoms that we've been describing. And another important thing that I want to mention is that there's a mental health condition called bipolar disorder that is usually associated with periods of depression and periods of anxiety. And so any prenatal care provider who is screening for depression and has a patient who screens positive should also be screening for bipolar disorder, because it may be not the garden variety depression that you think it is.
So I've called my OBGYN now. I have concerns about my mental health. I've called my OBGYN. We talked about some mood stabilizing medications, but I'm wondering if there are other sort of treatment options that are in the arsenal to help us work through postpartum mental health issues, and what other kinds of things you offer or suggest to your patients.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that is such an important question, right? Because I alluded to that medication is not the first line therapy. So what is? The first line therapy treatment is therapy or counseling, or some people call it talk therapy. And this happens with a trained therapist because there are specific types of therapy that work. And so the two most common types that are recommended are called cognitive behavioral therapy and interpersonal therapy. And both of these have been shown to help patients to manage their depression and anxiety symptoms. Therapy can sometimes be used alone for anxiety and depression, and that can be sufficient to help people get to a state where their mood is not negatively impacting their health. We know that counseling reduces symptoms and reduces the risk of some of the negative outcomes that we talked about earlier. So that's usually where we start. For my patients who present with kind of more severe symptoms or who have been doing therapy and it's not enough, that's when we typically start talking about adding medication. And so that's where kind of the medicines that we talked about earlier come into play. But those aren't our only options.
What about non-medication options?
Yeah, as I mentioned before, breastfeeding, definitely a big help in preventing or alleviating some of these anxiety or depression symptoms that we talked about. Also very important for bonding. We also know that regular exercise and nutritious diet makes a big difference. As I mentioned, things like excessive caffeine can really exacerbate anxiety symptoms. And having a diet that is relatively low sugar and low caffeine and highly nutritious is generally going to make us feel better, whether we're postpartum or not. And same goes with exercise. And so you're going to want to work with your healthcare provider to kind of determine what is the right level of exercise for you immediately after you've delivered, because it would be mean and inconsiderate for me to say that you should go, run for 30 minutes after you just had a baby. But there are things that you can be doing depending on what your delivery looked like and how quickly you are recovering. So that is something that I kind of also think is needs to be discussed on a case-by-case basis with people. But we know that having regular exercise as part of your routine is going to help to prevent some of these mental health concerns.
I also wanted to talk about a newer medication that I think was USDA approved in the summer of 2023, so hasn't been on the market super long. And I understood it as an oral medication to treat postpartum depression. I am curious, I guess, to know what it is and what makes it different from options that were already available on the market, because this did seem like it could be kind of a sea change in how very severe postpartum depression is handled.
Yeah, it's a really important medicine that has just newly become available. It was FDA approved in August of 2023, and it is called zuranolone. That's the generic name. It's also known as Zurzuvae. If it sounds like I don't say that a lot, it's because I haven't had that many opportunities to prescribe it yet. But I've had a few. And it is used to treat moderate to severe depression. And the thing that makes it particularly special is that it has a very rapid onset. This is a pill that people take daily for 2 weeks, and usually within just 1 or 2 days, they are noticing that their mood is improving. This is in contrast to the other medicines that we were previously talking about, like sertraline. The medicines in that class typically take 2 to 4 weeks before we start to get an improvement. And as you can imagine, if somebody is really in distress at this time where they have a newborn and are not able to care for themselves or their infant, that lag time is very important. This medicine is, it works on a part of the brain that is called a GABA receptor, and it is a type of medicine called an allopregnanolone. You don't need to remember any of that, but what you can remember is that it is basically stabilizing the body's progesterone response. So progesterone is a very important hormone that is a little higher in pregnancy and the postpartum time, and it can go through big fluctuations after delivery. And it's thought that this is contributes to some of these mood changes. So I'm really excited for this medicine to have this option for people. At this point, we have phase 3 FDA trials that show that it is safe for pregnant people and for breastfeeding infants, but this is very early information. We do not have long-term data on the safety of this for women or newborns. And so as people choose to use this medicine, they're needing to have careful conversations with their prescribers about whether or not this is the best choice for them at this time.
Earlier, you mentioned a study about sort of more long-term outcomes that you wanted to make sure we got to talk about a little bit. Can you tell me a little bit about this research that you wanted to share?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm very excited about this. I am an investigator on a national research study seeking to better understand how infant and child development occurs and what things influence it. We are particularly interested in how things like mental health and the medicines we use and the substances people are exposed to affect their children. This study is called the Healthy Brain and Child Development, or HBCD, study. And it's a national study that is sponsored by the National Institutes of Health. If you are currently pregnant and you are interested in learning more or participating, then I'd encourage you to check out the website hbcdstudy.org. And if we can put that in our show notes, I would be thrilled to have people interact with them.
Yeah, absolutely. There will be a link to that study in the show notes as well. Dr. McDonald, thank you so much for everything that you've talked us through. As we kind of approach the end of our conversation, do you have any top 3 takeaways or things that you really hope new parents know and understand, or even repeating parents, honestly, know and understand about postpartum mental health concerns?
Sure. I think there's probably 2 main points that need to be made. And one is just that this is super common basic health care. This is something that, you know, if you know 5 people who have been pregnant, you probably know at least 1 person who has dealt with mental health issues. And by normalizing this, by looking out for it, by understanding your resources, by providers doing better screening, we can all work together to take better care of people who are delivering our, you know, precious family members. Number 2 is that if you are concerned about your safety or your ability to keep your baby safe, then please, please, please reach out to help as early as possible. We know that suicide deaths are something that pregnant and birthing people continue to be at risk of for up to a year after delivery. And so really being on the lookout for somebody who does not seem bonded to their child or who is demonstrating self-harm or perhaps using unsafe ways of coping with stress like alcohol or substance use, these are all big red flags that we really need to pay attention to and make sure that we're getting people the support that they need.
Dr. McDonald, thank you so much for joining us today on the Women's Healthcast. This was a real pleasure.
It was my pleasure, mostly.
All the resources mentioned by Dr. McDonald during this episode are linked in our episode description. You can find the episode description at womenshealthcast.podbean.com. The Women's Healthcast is a production of the UW-SMPH Department of OBGYN. This episode was produced and engineered by Rob Garza. OBGYN Communications intern Paige Stevenson provided research support. You can listen to the Women's Healthcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And you can find the UW Department of OBGYN on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram under the handle at WISCOBGYN. Let us know how we're doing. Rate and review us in your podcast app and let us know what fourth trimester health issues you'd like to learn about at the link in our episode description. Thanks for listening.